hypnotherapist Dr. Michael Newton, who passed to the spirit world on the 22nd of September 2016, was one of those people. Over a period of 35 years, Michael collected an abundance of mind-blowing cases of people moving via deep hypnosis into the superconscious state to explore the spiritual realm. He left a growing interest in past life regression behind to create a methodology that allowed a deep and detailed exploration of the interlife, a place he called Life Between Lives, LBL. In short, he interviewed people in their soul state about what they encountered there. The result was the unfolding of incredible cases of meetings with spiritual guides, with the councils of elders to plan the purpose for the current incarnation, and reunions with soul group members with whom we incarnate regularly. Michael Newton is the author of three best-selling books: Journey of Souls, Case Studies of Life Between Lives, first published in 1994. The follow-up, Destiny of Souls, New Case Studies of Life Between Lives, in the year 2000. And Life Between Lives Hypnotherapy, 2004, published by Llewellyn. Now, these books have been translated into over 25 languages. In 2001, his second book was awarded Metaphysical Book of the Year by the Independent Publishers Association at their annual Book Exposition of America meeting. He's also the editor of Memories of the Afterlife, published in 2009, which includes intriguing case studies written by members of TNI's growing global network of Life Between Lives therapists. TNI. The Newton Institute. The Newton Institute's president, Peter Smith, whose introduction, which was published in the Psychic News UK, is how I started this tribute. Peter is going to be our guest in the program. Michael Newton had amazing effects on so many people. His first book, Journey of Souls, I know, changed my life. But how did it all start? Well, let's hear from Michael Newton himself.
I was introduced to past life kind of inadvertently. What happened to me was that I had this man who called early on in my years of practice and said to me, he did not ask for a past life regression. He simply said to me, I wonder if you could deprogram an injury that I think I sustained in childhood. That still bothers me, and it's getting worse, and I'm not sleeping well. And I asked if he'd been to medical doctors about this. Oh, yes, many x-rays. They consider my case as one where I simply psychologically have built up something that doesn't exist in terms of a medical problem. And I really need your help. So naturally, I took this gentleman, and I asked him where his pain was, and he explained that it was in the side, always in the same place under the ribs, lower down, on his left side. And so I took him into his childhood. We worked for a while in his childhood, and got nowhere. He simply, I thought maybe he'd fallen on a kitchen knife, for example, at a young age. Nothing. Nothing came out at all. So finally, in frustration, I said to him, I want you to go to the source of your pain. When was the first time that you felt this pain? Now, I need to tell you that this man was very somnambulistic. He went very deep, very quickly into hypnosis. In fact, he was ahead of me. And what had happened is that he had gone into a deeper alpha state, in what we call an upper alpha state, rather than a middle or more shallow alpha state, which is where I typically work with childhood trauma. So, suddenly, he's screaming, and I'm wondering, what's going on here? And he said, I'm being bayoneted. And I said, where are you? Now, being a historian, it didn't take me long to realize when he mentioned the Somme that we were in World War I, and that this man was at the First Battle of the Somme. It was July 1st, 1916, and if I'm not mistaken, there were about 20,000 men killed that day. He was a British sergeant in the 4th Corps. I checked all this out later, incidentally, but at the time, I just couldn't believe this was happening to me. And he explained that He was dying in the mud from a bayonet wound. Now, a kind person, a true psychotherapist, would have been trying to help this poor man get through this. But I didn't believe what was happening. So I wanted to know his name, rank, and serial number. I wanted to know if he would turn and look at the patch on his uniform and tell me what division he was in. These kinds of things, as a researcher, I looked to this first rather than trying to help this poor fellow. And I'm ashamed of this today, but this is what actually happened. So finally, I took pity on him after I got an awful lot of information. And we discerned exactly what was happening to him and why. And then I deprogrammed his injury, pulled him out of it, pulled him above it. And he became very quiet. So after that, I awakened him. We talked about what had happened. And he said he felt wonderfully refreshed. I was glad because I didn't feel refreshed. I didn't feel I'd done my job. But apparently it was all he needed. And he went back home. He called me 2 or 3 days later. And he said, my wife wants to thank you. I'm now sleeping at night so she too can sleep. And so from that case, I realized that I needed to probably get with the program and find out what's going on here spiritually and so forth. Now, mind you, this did not prevent me from checking with the British War Office and the Imperial Museum in London. And I found out the facts of this case, that there really truly was such a person, and he did exist in this particular division and unit at the time, and he described the battle perfectly. So from that case, I began to start accepting past life clients. A little bit at a time, mind you, I was still doing a lot of traditional work. It wasn't an awfully long time after that when I had my second case. And I mentioned this background to you because I think it's important for you to understand where I'm coming from as far as how I've arrived at where I am today. A woman came to me with feelings of isolation. She was very disturbed. I thought this was a typical case of someone who was depressed. She felt none of her friends were around her. She felt lonely. She felt disconnected from society. Okay. So I took her first into her childhood. We talked about childhood friends. There were not many. And apparently they did not relate to the people she was looking for. So then I moved her into a past life. Now, once again, I need to tell you that this lady was very somnambulistic. She went very deep, very fast. And she, too, was getting a little ahead of me. Only the difference between this case and the World War I soldier was that she'd gone even deeper into what we call the theta state. She was in a superconscious state. I asked her to, once again in frustration, when we did not have any results from her past life, where she saw a few friends, but not the people she was looking for, go to the place and time when you last saw your group of friends that you're missing. This was the key. This unlocked the door for me, because the word group is a trigger word, because we have spiritual groups. Suddenly, she was in the spirit world. I, of course, did not know there was such a thing. Most people who work in past life regression think that there's nothing more than a grayish limbo between lives. And, of course, today I know this is not true. In this woman's case, she began to cry. She was laughing for joy and crying at the same time with her eyes closed, pointing to my office wall. There they all are. And I said, where are we? I thought we jumped into another life. I didn't know where we were. Oh, she said, I'm in the spirit world. These are my soulmates. These are my spiritual friends. And I'm thinking, oh my God, why me? I mean... you couldn't pick a more inappropriate person than myself for this kind of analysis. I was not that metaphysical. I truly wasn't. I did my best, as I had done with a man in World War I, and I found out a little bit about this soul group and discovered that she truly was between lives. And I just want to tell you that from these two cases, I began to realize there was much more of the world that I didn't know of, and that, in fact, I had been given with this tremendous gift to be given a key to learn the things that I've wanted to learn all my life up to that time. Who are we? Why are we here? Who sent us? And where are we going?
As I said before, Michael Newton had an impact on so many people, not only through his books, his work, but the talks that he gave. At one lecture, a member of the audience rose to his feet and demanded, "This simply can't be true. How many cases have you done?" Michael replied simply and truthfully, "Oh, around 7,000. The fellow sat back down without further comment. Another extract from Peter Smith's wonderful tribute, published in the Psychic News UK, a full version of which is on our website. I spoke with Peter Smith, the president of the Newton Institute, who's had so much to do with Michael in recent years.
Peter, you've had a long association with Michael Newton, and of course it was very sad a few weeks ago when we learned of his passing, but sad in one way, but not in another. What are your immediate thoughts now?
Well, for us, Barry, it's an interesting time, because given that his whole field of expertise was the afterlife and where we go, he's now pursuing that personally. And Michael always advocated the duality of who we are, that we are this spiritual being having a human experience. So we're very much, as a community at the Newton Institute, we're in that duality right now as the human part of us goes through grief and the loss of somebody who was so dear to us as the founder of our organisation. But at the same time, we know exactly where he is and probably what he's doing, and that he's now free from a body that was showing the signs of age at the ripe old age of 84 that he was. He's now free of that, and he's exploring the afterlife and has earned his reward in many ways.
Yeah. Before we get on to his where he is in the afterlife and whatever, looking back, how long is it that you have known Michael now?
Well, it'll be 10 years. Mm-hmm. 10 years since I've worked with him, and a group of us built the Newton Institute with him as our founder. And in that time, I believe our therapist network has increased some threefold. We started off about 50 or 60 people back in 2005 when we first founded. And that was the continuation of the previous organisation, Society for Spiritual Regression. So when we became the Newton Institute back in 2005, we were around that 50 or 60 therapists worldwide. And now we're over 200 across 40 countries. So it's been a steady period of growth. Yeah. Over that period of time.
Okay, let's go back further into the past. Michael Newton, of course, is probably best known to many people worldwide, as is he looking over at his library sitting next to us here. Journey of Souls, Destiny of Souls, They were the first two books that I read, and that influenced, had a tremendous impact on my life. It was after the passing of my partner in the late 90s, and that helped me cope with the whole situation. And of course he went back a long way further than that. Let's talk about his amazing career.
Well, Michael was a wonderful mix of spiritual adventurer and down-to-earth researcher, and he wanted to understand this to the extent where he could advocate this as a journey that we all take. And over 35 years he accumulated some 7,000 case studies. And if you look back to when his first accidental life between lives session happened in 1968.
Accidental?
Yeah.
And are there accidents?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. There was great synergy in this one, and perhaps we'll tell that story in a moment. But Journey of Souls wasn't published around, published around the mid-90s. So we had something like, you know, the best part of 30 years worth of research in there before he even went public with this information. And in his words to me, he wanted to stay very focused and very methodical. And, you know, I need a few thousand case studies. Now I need a few thousand more. So by the time this was shared with the world, there was a level of depth and breadth and robustness that this whole body of work could not be dismissed by anybody.
No, it's not anecdotal, that's for sure.
Yeah, so perhaps that story back from 1968, and here's a guy that had studied to be a therapist and a hypnotherapist, and you know, he'd done a PhD in counselling psychology and all that. A very learned fellow. And he has a client in his chair, and he'd even refused past life therapy to many people at that point in time. Oh, I don't want to do that sort of thing. That was his early stance in his career.
Did he at the time have any belief in an afterlife or continuing life or whatever?
For him the jury was out. He was very much the researcher. He needed to see proof, even of metaphysical things. But he'd always loved the metaphysical. He loved, connecting with nature and knowing that there was a power and an energy in nature that transcended what we built here in our cities, etc. So he spent a lot of time in nature, loved hiking in the mountains. From the back door of his house in California back in the olden days, he could see the High Sierras, and it was like they were calling him to a greater energy. So he loved that. He always loved crystals. He loved his crystals. His garden in California had big chunks of...
Which is probably unusual at the time for somebody who was in mainstream psychology.
Yeah, very much so, but he was destined for greater things, as we all know now.
Yeah, but he obviously had an open mind about things like crystals and that, so...
He was this incredibly interesting mix, Barry, between cynic and spiritual explorer. And he would take nothing for granted. He'd say, well, I need to take that into another session and I need to test that out with other people. And he built models and he built approaches to the spiritual realm. And he asked some very dedicated research-type questions. And he was, at times, an absolute terrier for exploring some of these issues with his clients. He saw himself as very much their advocate, and he was there to find their answers.
It's not a bad way to be, really. A cynic may be going a little bit out to the extreme, but to be a true skeptic in the way the ancient Greeks had it, so that you're questioning with an open mind, as opposed to going in and questioning because you want to debunk it, that's not a bad way to be able to... then say, okay, I want proof.
Yeah, a spiritual skeptic. That's a great summary. I like that.
So this case changed his life, this woman going back to the world of spirit and her soul family. Did he embrace the concept of soul families, or was that a whole new thing for him as well?
Well, something that he discovered after a period of time. And as he started to take people beyond past lives, it was all about, building the conditioning of a client and moving back through... First of all, childhood regression, then regression in the womb. And as he built the model, we have a conscious and we have a subconscious and we have a superconscious. So those three levels of mind, he was like discovering this third one and helping to activate it in ways that we don't normally enjoy human form.
Talking about the superconscious here.
Absolutely.
Okay, for those who don't know a lot about the superconscious or would like to know more, can you give us a little bit of a heads up, the superconscious?
Absolutely. Well, if we go down through levels of memory, if we look at us in our conscious state here, and you and I are having a great conversation in the studio now, and we're very much in our conscious mind, in our beta brainwave patterns. Mm. As we relax, as we reflect, we move into an alpha brainwave pattern, which is more the realms of the subconscious. Mm-hmm. Of course, everything that we've ever experienced is stored there. As we descend further through the subconscious, which is still active, of course, and runs a lot of programs in our behavior, as we descend further into the theta brainwave patterns, we start to open the superconscious. Now, these are memories that we haven't had access to in this lifetime. And actually, our soul memories are held in those deeper brainwave patterns as well. So to establish a life-between-life state, what we're doing is we're really helping people to embrace a level of trance where they can have the memories of an out-of-body experience while still in body.
Mm-hmm.
The process in which we obtain this is to first we'll get somebody into a nice, relaxed state where their subconscious is open and then take them deeper. And as we move deeper into like the theta range of brainwave patterns, the soul memories then open.
Hmm. So did Michael develop this himself?
He developed what we now refer to as the Newton methodology. We would gradually sensitize a client over a long and involved process where we would go back through childhood memories, back into the womb. And I'll come back to that in a moment because it's quite an interesting aspect. Then into past lives, and then to go through the death scene of that past life and back into the spiritual realm to follow the client's superconscious mind as it leaves the past life and travels back to its true home in the spiritual realm. And that was, as he called it, going through the front door, because that's a very natural process because at the end of each lifetime, we go back to spirit.
Mm.
So he basically took his clients through into the past life, fully with the intention of crossing them over, going back into spirit through the front door. Now, the reason that the womb period was so important as well is that as we have the conscious and the subconscious and the superconscious, our subconscious, for the likes of you and me, we've been here for some decades, our subconscious is full of the experiences of this lifetime. So we've got our conscious, our subconscious, and our superconscious. When we're in the womb, our subconscious mind for this lifetime is pretty much empty, okay, because we haven't yet had those experiences. So it's much easier to activate superconscious memory and ask a number of trigger questions in that period where we can start to activate superconscious mind. An example of that might be, how does this body compare to others that you've occupied? We get responses like, well, I'm choosing female this time, or I'm choosing male this time around, or this is smaller than what I normally select. So we're drawing on that superconscious memory by comparing this life to others that activate the lineage of the soul.
So when you say select, you mean you sort of go into a little demonstrator catalogue and say, well, I'll have one of them.
Yes.
It's a bit smaller than I'm used to, but I suppose I'll squeeze
in. Which is the vehicle that I want to drive this time around.
Yeah.
It's, very much so. And there are options available to us. And if we look at the intention for our soul to develop through a particular lifetime, then there's a particular vehicle that is more suitable for the purpose that it may offer, the decision points for free will, something that helps us to perhaps even break a pattern that's gone across many lifetimes, which is one of the real benefits of this work, is that we have a sweeping view across the lineage of the soul. What are the patterns across lifetimes? Rather than going into a past life to discover one other persona that is part of the lineage of our soul, this lays it open for that whole journey. Which is why Journey of the Soul was a title that came to him.
It wouldn't the physical body also have something to do with the fact that if you're going to be born to two tiny parents or you're going to be born to two very large parents with that kind of DNA there and you choose a small body would sort of be uncomfortable or just wouldn't fit the pattern of that particular familial heritage?
Could well be. And sometimes we'll choose a body that has a great synergy with the energy of our soul. And sometimes we'll choose one that has contrast, and even in that comes the learnings. A soul that likes to be busy may choose a slower or even damaged body in which to live their life, because in there lie the greatest lessons.
When we say choose, there's still a lot of help from our guides and elders and whatever.
The loving spiritual beings that have such an interest in us.
So it's a committee decision.
Yeah, collaborative effort.
A collaborative effort. I like that. Peter, tell us about Michael Newton himself. What sort of man was he? What were your impressions? Was he a gentle man, a generous man? We know about his inquiring mind, but give us a little thumbnail sketch of Michael Newton.
Well, I describe him as the sort of guy that was far more at home hiking through the mountains than as a leader in the emerging New Age movement back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, when all of this started to hit the fanfare.
He wouldn't have seen it as New Age, though, or himself as New Age.
He saw himself as probably on the robust side of that wave of people. He really wanted robustness was what all this was about, because the things that he was discovering were so different from what had been discovered before. And the Bardo, if you like, was seen as this place where we went in the realm of reincarnation. We sort of bounced into the next life without a lot of debrief or planning. He's really the first one that put some structure and order between where we go, between those incarnations. And of course, it's been validated by lots of other aspects of people's studies that have done the afterlife.
But Michael was the pioneer in this.
Yeah. He's the first one that significantly mapped it. I mean, there's lots of references to other pieces of work, and there's been I think Ray Moody did some great work with 100 near-death experiences. Helen Wambach did some great work with about 700 past life studies. So there's great chunks of work, but nothing really goes to 7,000 separate clients, all done under clinical conditions that brought forward the trends of this work. So as a person, he had this absolute dogmatic desire to bring this work forward, but he was still happy to be a spiritual trailblazer to take us into a field of work that had yet been discovered. As a person, he's a far more humble man than what many people would envisage. He didn't really like the limelight. For most of his final years, he lived pretty much as an interested recluse, just tapping into the Newton Institute and guiding and steering us on matters of significance as we involved him. He was always one to have an opinion, but always wanted to be asked. And he just really wanted a quiet life in the end. And he loved his walks in the mountains. And he loved spending time with his long-term soulmate, Peggy. And he just really had the greater desire for the quiet life.
So he was able to identify Peggy as a soulmate, a soul. What's your definition of soulmate?
Well, ultimately, there's a very connected partner for which we may have shared many lifetimes. And there's a knowing of each other's unconsciously, of course, about having shared the soul lineage together, played many roles for each other, a deep, profound, loving care. And, you know, there might be one or even two souls in our group that that we connect with in this way.
Yeah, so it doesn't always have to be a love partner.
Yeah, exactly.
Many
loving relationships, and they take many forms.
That's right. Well, that's the Hollywood image, isn't it? You know, I've got to go and find my soulmate and then we'll fall into each other's arms.
It's been romanticised a lot, but ultimately, you know, I've seen clients come through my clinic over the years where I need to find my soulmate, and they, through Life Between Lives, meet them in spirit, and they say they're not supposed to be together in this lifetime because they're learning some aspects of, you know, being able to stand alone and to do some things with the absence of that energy that they might have even become too dependent on.
Yes, there's a lot talked about soulmates and everything like that, but you don't have to have a soulmate to have happiness in a relationship.
Yeah.
I guess that's the point that comes through, isn't it?
Well, I believe that as souls we are unique, and whilst it's great to learn in the company of others, and souls do love to collaborate and to learn together, we are still one aspect of a unique consciousness that is part of all there is. And, you know, the journey of our souls is as unique as we are in that superconscious state.
Okay, back to Michael. And 1994, he published Journey of Souls.
Yeah.
That was obviously a very, very successful book for him. It's still selling, I would imagine. I know I refer a lot of people to it. And then he followed that up. Obviously, there needed to be a follow-up with Destiny of Souls.
Yeah, that was around 7 years later.
Pick up the story from then. What was he still seeing active clients all this time?
He was. He retired from clinical practice in around 2002. You know, from then on, he knew that he had to teach other people. Mm. So he started to run some trainings in different places. You know, Hollywood, he ran one of his first ones because that was his old stomping ground from his youth. He grew up in California in Hollywood and lived the later part of his life further away, down on the other side of Sacramento. So he knew it was time to teach. He knew that this work was very unique. He knew that he had to hand his work on to the next generation of hypnotherapists. And that's why he wrote his third book in the end, Life Between Lives, and that was published around 2004 from memory. And at that stage, it was more of a handbook for Life Between Lives therapists and what is it that they would, you know, would do. He advocated that the book was a start and that it's pre-reading for people that we train still. But to actually experience it for yourself and to offer it to other people as well would then carry a sacred trust. And he saw that, you know, this work really carried a lot of spiritual responsibility to open somebody's soul, to have their soul there, working with that person in that deeper state of being is something that was profound and humbling experience. And you were no longer a therapist, but a facilitator of immortal energies that were emerging. And, you know, that is something that to this day we remind our people is, you know, something very sacred.
So what kind of people were coming to Michael at that time? Did he talk about that? Were they emerging connections with their consciousness? Was it the New Age set? Was it the Hollywood set? Was it the average person? This was a very turning point in our consciousness growth, wasn't it, the beginning of the millennium?
Yeah. Interestingly, Barry, they were pretty much all word of mouth. He would do a session for somebody, they would tell somebody else, they would be drawn to come. And ultimately, I think there was probably 7,000 wonderful souls that signed up to be his subjects for that first body of work before they came here. So, you know, they just came. They just came. They came from all walks of life, one of the great parts of this research is, regardless of ethnic background, regardless of profession, religious beliefs, everybody had very similar experiences. You know, many of them identical, which is where he started to identify the trends and the pieces of the work that were emerging as key components. Meeting with a spiritual counsel, returning to a soul group, patterns across lifetimes, interlife activities, the things that we do in the construction and the displaying of energy when we're over there. The library, you know, going and looking up the records of perhaps the journey of your own soul, or even the Akashic records of broader themes. All of these started to emerge completely independently within these sessions that allowed him to track those trends.
Interesting. Because by the time he was really getting going with all of this, he was well in his 60s at this stage.
Yeah, pretty much.
So there was a whole... I mean, how many people are retiring at mid-60s and then going off and going fishing or playing golf or something like that? He is just really starting to push towards his peak.
I think we see that with a lot of the great spiritual teachers. I mean, the older they become, the more wisdom that they hold. And I think retirement is in the, you know, the perhaps the 60s is great for those who have a profession, but for those who have a purpose, there is no retirement. I think Michael was a good example of that. Even, you know, when he passed away in September, he was coming towards his 85th birthday. But ultimately, he'd never stopped. And he was still, you know, commenting on things. He was still guiding us. He was still offering his wisdom whenever he had the chance to do so.
Well, 85 is a pretty good innings. In, I think the average male lifespan is around about 80, 81 or something like that. Yeah. So you were in constant contact with him. Did he give you the impression that he'd achieved everything he wanted to in this lifetime? Did he ever talk about that?
He did. He felt that in the last few years, when he stepped even further back from our organisation and from supporting our group, there was very much a theme of it's your turn now, people who follow him. And he succeeded by 200 different people doing this work around the world now. No one person could ever fill his shoes, so we need 200 to do that. So
at least.
Yeah. And more, of course, as we continue to train people internationally. And, you know, the Newton Institute family continues to grow, which is beautiful, bringing different cultures, new countries. You know, we're starting to train in different languages now as well. We ran a German training this year, running an Italian one next year. We ran one, a dual English and Mandarin in Malaysia just a few years ago.
Yeah.
So ultimately, we're starting to move worldwide. I mean, he knew it was his turn to hand on to us. And a couple of quotes that he offered me, and even in my last conversation with him, just a few weeks before he passed, he said to me that he felt that we were offering something to people that they just can't get elsewhere. He felt that this connection with the superconscious aspect of our being was something that was just so powerful and just so beautiful, and it can't be replicated. The methodology of how this emerged and the robustness of its roots, I mean, this is a field of work that is of great significance. Humanity, as we're moving towards a greater consciousness and trying to let things fall away that don't serve us. Clearly on this planet there's some aspects of our consciousness we need to surrender so that we can move further into what our true potential is as a species.
Did Michael accept the fact that this was a role that he had agreed to prior to this lifetime, that this was his true purpose?
He was very plugged into that, Barry. His own journeys, of course, into his own aspects of his deeper consciousness, of course, remained private to him. And in the very private and personal person that he was, then that's where they truly belong. But he did make comment from time to time about the greater purpose behind all of this, that this is an absolute awakening of consciousness for humanity. He once referred to our work as a movement, you know, a movement, something going forward that would move people into a different consciousness from where they'd been. And, you know, we were getting so much feedback, mail. He would get a bag of mail every month through his publishers at Llewellyn. And ultimately, this was about bringing hope and inspiration to people to help them know absolutely, totally and completely that they are the spiritual being having a human experience. It just changes your perspective on life. Fear of death just disappears. And he once said to me, and whilst he had a lot of respect for all of traditional religions, he had no real tolerance for dogma, because all religions have love, peace, compassion at their core. But ultimately, how we interpret that can lead to a structure and a dogma that holds people back. And I remember him saying to me once that one of the things that he loved about this work was that people could understand that the spiritual realm belonged to everybody, and the afterlife was not something that they needed to earn.
From my memory, he refuted any question of a place like hell.
Yeah, and in fact,
my research said exactly the same thing. You know, when we're talking about religion, you know, it's a very handy place to relegate you to if you don't do what we tell you.
Well, having seen many, many hundreds of sessions now as well, you know, I've never seen any traces of the fires of Hades or any of that sort of thing on the other side. It's just love, peace, not even any judgment. And I think that sometimes we judge ourselves, and I think that, you know, there are some aspects of judgment that come through from people's religious indoctrinations, if I can say that as respectfully as I can. You know, religion is a great start to help us understand there is more to us than we know, that we're all an aspect of a greater consciousness. But to actually experience it firsthand is something that changes lives.
Peter, how long have you known Michael Newton?
About 10 years.
About 10 years, okay. You've had a lot to do with him as a teacher. Mm. What kind of a teacher was he?
He was a wonderful teacher in that he would tell stories, Barry. I think great teaching is about inspirational stories that actually articulate the work in action. And it's one thing to be able to take people into a deep realm of hypnosis, but what do you do with them once you get there? And he would often tell stories. He'd tell funny stories. He'd tell sad stories. You know, when he would talk, he would have us rolling on the floor 1 minute and a tear in our eye the next with a beautiful, moving story. And I remember once that, you know, in all these techniques where we gradually build someone's sensitivity. And I remember him teaching in the UK in 2006. We had a big class. We had about 40 people in that class. And we had one lady put up her hand, and we'd always done this sensitization of the client to get them back in time. And we'd go back in time and we'd look for a childhood memory at around 12, another one around 7. And I remember somebody putting their hand up in class and saying, "Excuse me." And he says, "Yes, what is it?" I said, "Why do you choose 12? Why would you do this at 12 years of age?" And Michael looked her in the eye and he said, "Don't you know?" He said, "Don't you know why we use 12? And she's saying, she's shaking, and he was just doing it all for the theatrics.
Yes.
He said, "Don't you know that when people turn 13, they become insane? They become teenagers." So he'd often use humour as part of that as well. So, yeah, and what we did in 2006 as well, we knew that he was moving into the end of his career, and we had another training that year in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Mm. And he taught every segment, and we recorded him. And now when we teach Life Between Lives instructors and people become teachers for the Newton Institute, we sit them down and we start with the purity of his teachings, and we get them to watch those DVDs and to make notes from them, and not just to regurgitate from the DVDs, but to take his learnings and to take them firsthand and to make them their own.
Assimilate them, yeah.
Yeah. And then to teach through their own style and methodology, but still in contact with that pure source of his teaching.
Mm-hmm. So how long do you think the legacy will continue, this style of teaching and this subject?
Well, when we first established the Newton Institute in 2005, when it came through from the old organisation, we knew that we wanted to establish this organisation so that future generations would be able to, you know, still draw their wisdom and their hope and their inspiration from Michael's teachings. So the whole thing was founded for future generations. So that'll continue now. We've got global expansion happening. We're across, as I mentioned before, 40 countries. We're starting to run Life Between Lives hypnotherapy trainings in different countries, different languages, different cultures. We've gone into Asia. We've run a number in Europe. North America, we're very strong. Australasia, you know, we've run 4 in Australia itself. So over the years, we've just become stronger and stronger. So, yeah, this is about picking up speed. And now that Michael's not with us any longer, we have that added incentive to continue this on in his legacy, in his name.
Yeah. Well, that's important, isn't it? So when did he actually finish teaching? Because as you said earlier, he passed at the age of just on 85. Obviously, he wasn't teaching right up until the very last minute.
Yeah, his last formal training, he retired after the 2000... and seven training in Chicago. He made a brief comeback in 2011, and we had a sneaky plot, if you like, to lure him back by running a training in just outside of San Francisco, and it was about an hour and a half from his house, and we knew he couldn't keep away. So he drove in, and at first he was going to drop in, and then he was going to stay a day or two, and in the end he stayed the whole week and taught some segments, and we had a whole new generation in 2011 that were able to leverage his teachings. And the beauty of that training was we had such a snapshot of and a cross-section of different people of different ages, and we had some younger people that came and trained as well. So he refreshed it then, but in 2007, that was his formal retirement. And it was after that Chicago training. And one of the things that made such an impression on us at that training was some closing remarks that he made about the sacred trust of this work and how we have a responsibility to the souls who come to us. And we've got a little recording of that training, and it would be great to share some of Michael's own words in how he felt this work should be conducted.
Okay, so let's hear that right now. Peter, it's great to have you, and thank you so much, not only your work with Michael Newton, but also helping us with this tribute. It's been an honour to be associated with it.
And thank you, Barry. It's great for us to be able to do this and to tell the world more about Michael's work now that he's left it with us.
You've all been a wonderful class. It's been a lot of fun. Every class is different. And you have your own special nuances that we all remember. And every class is very interesting to deal with. And you are a unique class, too. And we learned a lot, I think. I just want to impress upon you that having gone through this process now yourself, I hope you all understand that this is going to make you a much better therapist. An LBL therapist. There are people out there that practice LBL without ever considering coming here and learning it properly. They work just out of the book, and I don't know, I guess a lot of you find. But having been through this process yourself is going to make you a better therapist. You've gained insight and understanding and passion from this. And I want to tell you all that with this brings a sacred trust. You are going to be, remember my opening remarks on the first day, working within your subject's inner mind and the dual nature between their brain and their soul. It carries an awesome responsibility that goes far beyond what you've done with past life regression. Yes, I'm very prejudiced, okay? And yes, I'm biased and all those other awful things. But I firmly believe in this. And there's something else I want to mention to you. Because of the fact that there are so few of you out there, it can bring good financial rewards, yes. But what worries some of us is that that can be a corrupting influence if you let it happen. You have got to maintain your humility and keep your ego in check during the years ahead when you're going to be in areas where you're going to be the only person that can do this. Okay, we hope in the decades ahead this is going to change, but in the years ahead, it probably won't. So you have to have, as Pete has mentioned, a very strong moral compass. Never forget that you are the servants of your clients and that you have the sacred trust to take them into a very sacred place and to encourage them to open their innermost feelings to you and deal with this in a way that befits the kind of work that you're doing. So I just want to leave you with the thought that I hope you will always retain this humility and that you work with courage and dedication and wisdom. And I want to wish you all the best of luck.
Ann Clark is the Director of Research for the Newton Institute.
I just received my training as an LBL therapist in 2011. I was very fortunate that that was the last year that he did any education before his retirement. And so I got to know him then. And then in 2014, I was elected as the director of research, and he called me almost immediately to offer his support, and we started working together from then on. We exchanged a lot of emails, and he helped me with many things.
Oh, right. So what was it like working with such an iconic figure?
He was absolutely brilliant, and he cared very much about the integrity of his work. When he started out and first made this discovery, he really did not have any belief in the afterlife. It was through all his experiences with his patients. And one of the things that I admired about him the most was, as a researcher, when we make a great discovery, like he did with evidence of the afterlife, it is very hard to keep it under wraps long enough to develop it further. And he was able to do that for years. Not only was he patient, but he was brilliant in the way he was able to put it all together and map out what the afterlife was like and devise a method to help individuals access that realm.
That's it, isn't it? He helped so many people. I know, speaking personally, when my partner passed in 1997, somebody gave me a copy of Journey of Souls, or recommended I read it, and it made a tremendous difference in my life. I wonder how many people's lives have been influenced by his work.
I think that it would be hard to count the number that have been influenced. Just this past week, one of my patients was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, which is very serious. There's only about a 25% survival rate. But she had done a life between life regression with me about a year ago, and she told me, "I'm not afraid. Now that I know that there's an afterlife, I know that I'm being watched over and protected by those from the other side, and that this is all part of a plan and part of my learning, I'm not at all afraid for whatever's to come." And that's what this work is all about.
That's right.
And that's the gift.
And who knows what difference that will make to that woman in whatever time she has or anybody else has left in this lifetime, knowing the fact that there's nothing to fear, knowing the fact that perhaps a healing is still possible.
Yes. And I think one of the greatest gifts that we've received from Michael's work was the absence of fear about death, because we know what's coming next.
Yeah, that's right. And it's really incredible in this day and age how much fear there still is, and how many people think that at the end of life somebody just flicks a switch and we all disappear off into darkness. I mean, to me that is absolutely ridiculous, but to a lot of people that's what life is about.
Yes. My last visit with Michael was in October of last year. I made the visit so we could discuss research and future directions, and we just had a wonderful time chatting about many ideas for research and where this would be going in the future. And I got to spend some time with Michael and his wife Peggy, who was truly his soulmate. It was interesting, as I was sitting there talking to him, I noticed after a while that he kept looking over his shoulder as he was talking to me. So finally I turned around, and there was Peggy, his wife, lovingly admonishing him, telling him, "Don't do all the talking." And I immediately said, "Oh, no, no, I want him to do all the talking. I'm hanging on every word."
Exactly.
And I really was.
Exactly. As if you're going to sit there and start telling Michael what you think about things after his accumulated wisdom.
Yes.
Oh, dear. Was he universally loved and accepted, or did he have any detractors? I mean, I would find it difficult to even pose the thought that there would be detractors.
Well, there certainly are people who don't believe in any of his work, but it was hard to question his integrity because he had done over 7,000 cases before he released his work, and it was hard to say anything against the method that he used. He used a very time-consuming, labor-intensive method. He did case studies, and then he aggregated and integrated all that data. And that's a very solid, robust research method for putting this kind of data together. So it was hard for anyone to question his his methods, but some still did question.
Despite all this, from what Pete Smith tells me, he is a very humble man.
He was very humble. He told me a really interesting story. He made comments through the years about how he was just in awe that someone like him would have received this information. But one of the funny stories he told me is, after the publication of his first book, Journey of Souls, Llewellyn sent him on a book tour, and he was at one of the big bookstores in Times Square in New York. And there was an overflow crowd, and so they ended up using a loudspeaker to provide the people out in the square with his talk. And so afterwards, because he wanted to get out for lunch, he snuck out the back door, got out into the square, and went to a food cart and found some lunch. And he was sitting there, and the man beside him said, "Well, I guess you missed the guru, didn't you?" And he just smiled and said, "Yeah, I guess I did."
Oh, that's a lovely story. Oh, dear. I believe there's still a lot of information that is still coming out, though, even after all these years, that Michael has sort of sat on and didn't believe people would be interested in.
Yes. At that last visit, he gave me a number of his unpublished case studies that we have been... we've put out a couple already in our research journal, Stories of the Afterlife. He also gave me a number of audio tapes of previous talks that he'd done, and he gave me a set of files about his answers to questions that people had had through the years. And a lot of this information will really expand upon what we already know.
Are there plans to release these tapes?
Yes, we will be putting out the information on those tapes, and we'll be releasing the case studies. Our Stories of the Afterlife Journal will be one of the outlets that will allow us to put out this information. And I also wanted to say that we're currently working on a book. The research committee is working on a book for Llewellyn. It's going to be entitled Llewellyn's Little Book of Life Between Lives, and it's scheduled for publication in 2018.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Now, as these tapes and things are released, Anne, where will people be able to find them to be able to discover and let Michael's legacy live on?
I would suggest that going to the website for the Newton Institute, and that's www.newtoninstitute.org, would be the best way to keep up with things.
Okay, that's great. So the Institute itself, in many cases, organizations tend to sort of quietly disappear when their founder passes. But people like Edgar Cayce, that certainly hasn't proved the case. And I feel very strongly that it won't happen with Michael Newton. What plans are there for the ongoing work of the Institute?
Well, we have actually been preparing for what we knew would be this eventuality for a long time. We knew that he wouldn't be with us forever, and so we've been planning for this. And in fact, my trip last October was to really help me get some directions for the future for our research. We are currently planning a number of research initiatives, and we plan to carry on the work that he started. Secondly, we have an advisory committee for the Newton Institute that is very active. Each one of us is carrying out a project that will help to bring the Newton Institute forward in the future. So we feel that we have a very strong organizational base. We feel very strongly about the importance of Dr. Michael Newton's work, and we will be carrying it forward.
And, of course, the work of LBL, Life Between Lives, that will continue as more and more practitioners worldwide are taking up the work?
Yes. The research committee did a survey in 2015, and we found that LBLs are being provided in 14 different languages in over almost 40 different countries, and we're increasing that number every year. And we calculate that approximately... somewhere around 36,000 life-between-life regressions have been done since Dr. Newton started training others to do this work.
And the training continues with the experts, some of the early experts? And
we normally have two or three trainings per year.
Excellent. And look, thank you so much for your time in this program. And I know Michael Newton must have relied on you a lot in his last few years in this lifetime. So thank you for being part of the tribute.
Thank you very much. And thank you for helping us do a tribute for Michael and to carry on his legacy.
Believe me, I'm honored. I'd like to conclude our tribute program to Michael Newton with a poem that he wrote at the beginning of Journey of Souls. You would know the hidden realm where all souls dwell. The journey's way lies through death's misty fell. Within this timeless passage, a guiding light does dance, lost from conscious memory, but visible in trance.